Welcome back to the podcast. My guest today is Kelly Reynolds. She grew up in Alaska. She's a pilot, a photographer, a hunter, and did some guest hosting of a podcast. Thanks for being on here, Kelly.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's start with the podcast, I guess. So you were a guest host. How did that all happen? And what was the podcast about?
Yeah, so I was a guest host on the Soul Summit podcast, which Courtney Preedy hosts, and she's the one who started it. She oversees her own company called Her Outdoor Journey. I have followed Courtney for a few years now on social media, and it's kind of interesting to reflect back on. She's probably one of the few people that I don't personally know that I've followed for so many years and really felt, you know, engaged with her content. And I really always liked what she was posting and how she talked about, you know, women in the outdoor space. So I've kind of been following her for a few years, and then this opportunity kind of popped up early this past winter for a co-host on her podcast. And, you know, in Fairbanks, Alaska, we just don't have that much going on in the middle of winter. And I definitely feel like my cup is a little bit depleted. Mm. So this opportunity came up and I was thinking, wow, this could be such a cool way for me to talk about and learn more about the things that I love to do outside of the wintertime. So it was a great experience. I brought on a couple of guests that I know very well and a guest that I've never met before. And it was just a really great opportunity.
Yeah, it's really fun to be able to connect with people and just have conversations. And that was the allure of not only listening to podcasts, but also being in a podcast. Such a cool feeling to be able to connect with people and just, you know, make friends with people by having them as guests or to talk with them as a podcast host.
Absolutely. And I, you know, after each episode that I would record, I kind of just walked away with this feeling like, wow, this is someone that I thought I knew pretty well, and look at all the things I just learned about them. And it's kind of made me rethink my personal and non-personal connections. Like, we just have so much to learn about the people around us, and it's not very often we take the time to really dig in and ask them questions. Mm-hmm. And so it was, just a really great experience to learn more about people I knew and didn't know.
Yeah. One of the main reasons I started this podcast was there's so much content about Alaska, but not really about Alaskans, as far as, you know, this Alaskan hunts. And so it was the deer that they got, the caribou they caught a 50-pound king salmon or whatever. So being able to talk to people about what it's like to live here in October, you know, what is life like up here in January? It was fun to kind of get that full story of living in Alaska. And that was a kind of an undertold story, I felt. So it's been fun to be able to share those commonalities, even though up in Fairbanks, it's way cooler than it is down here in Southeast. It's almost like a different state, but we still have that common ground as being Alaskans.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's pretty normal to gravitate only towards talking about hunting, which so many of us love, but there's so much more that goes on in our lives to support these few weeks really of our year. And so I just really love hearing how people work so hard throughout an entire year or years to make their dreams happen. So it's kind of, you know, being in Alaska and there people kind of see this really glamorous side, especially with social media, like these amazing hunts or these amazing fishing trips or flights or dog sledding expeditions, whatever it is. And it's not often that you learn about what it really took to get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whenever anybody asks me or asks for recommendations about what to do when they come to Alaska, I say, talk to the locals. And if you're coming up on a fishing charter, talk to the kids who are cutting your fish, because that's some, you know, 15 or 16 year old kid who is going to have to wake up at 2 a.m. once the fish is frozen to then box it and get it to your flight. So get an idea of what it's like to live here as a kid. It's just such an interesting story and something that you don't think about, and it's not in the brochure, but meet the people who live there full time. It makes the experience so much better.
Totally, totally.
So one of the angles from the podcast, you were talking about women specifically in the outdoors.
Yeah, I kind of, and that was not the entire focus of the podcast. It's really encouraging everyone in the outdoors, but it is specifically a little bit more focused on encouraging women in the outdoor space. And that's something I've just really gravitated towards and kind of put some more thought and effort into both what are ways I can kind of bring myself into the outdoor space more, and how can I help encourage others to do so as well.
I grew up on Prince of Wales Island and then went to college in Arizona. Then my first teaching job out of college was in California. And I remember I signed a self-assessment essay for my sophomores. And one of the girls wrote that the thing she loved to do most in her life was to hunt elk with her dad. And so I'm reading this. I think that is awesome. What a great thing to have. But then as the essay continued, she talked about how because she was a cheerleader type, she felt too scared to tell her friends that that's what she loved to do because she was afraid that they would judge her. And I thought,
Oh,
that is awful, absolutely horrible. And
it
it wasn't even the part of California where you would think that, it's just all like Southern California materialism.
Yeah.
This was more in the interior, that the Central Valley area. So that was, it was horrible. I told her, if they're really your friends, they're not going to care, or they will care and they'll think it's awesome.
Yeah, that makes me really sad, but I think that's a pretty common problem that I don't want to speak for all women, obviously, but it has taken some time to find that balance of is it okay for me to be girly like on a hunt, or is it okay for me to talk about hunting over in a girl's night? Like it kind of feels like an oddity a little bit. And I think that where we're at today, kind of culturally and especially with social media, it's just really evident to me that you can, anybody can be all the things that they want in one person. You can really be polar opposites in your hobbies or your profession, and you can make it work. You don't have to just dedicate all of your time or experiences to one thing.
Some of the best hunters and most outdoorsy, just big time outdoors people that I know have always been women. It's just kind of part of the culture here. So do you, it's kind of, I don't even know really how to ask the question. Do you think it's more that maybe the hunting or outdoors community is just kind of getting to giving voice to what already is part of the culture in a place like Alaska? Because I'm sure growing up, there may have been something about expectations about, boys do this, girls do this, but in Alaska, that's not necessarily the norm.
Totally. Yeah, I think, back when I was growing up in my immediate household, like the expectation was whatever my brother could do, I would also do. And we just didn't really have those like gender roles, I guess. So my parents both did a great job of that. But outside of our family, it was not really like that, especially like with my friends or even my cousins or anything like that. And I think that, jumping back now to today, I do think we're normalizing the fact that women have been in this space for a long time, but maybe kind of gaining more respect in the outdoor community. On the podcast, I kind of talked a little bit about like the difference in gear over the last 20 years that I've seen. And we have so many more options today than we ever did, even 5, 10 years ago, for women's gear. And so, kind of going back to your question, it's like, has this always been the case, but we just haven't been, it hasn't been highlighted. And I think that far fewer women were a part of, in the hunting community 15 plus years ago. But I think due to social media, it's amazing to me to see how many women have never had any experience hunting and they just want to get into it and they do it on their own. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I had a friend who was it was super happy with how far that people have come in general, and so many hunters and anglers and alpinists or whatever just treat people like people, and you're either a badass or you're not. It's not like you're a badass for a girl, but there are some people who are kind of dismissive of it, and it's still, oh, you're such a, it's an amazing hunter because you're a girl, and so you're not expected to be so good at this stuff. Do you see that we're kind of overcoming that subtle diss as like a you're a great hunter for a girl type thing?
That's a really, really good question. Yes, I think we are kind of getting over that. Like I think when I'm really impressed that a girl did some kind of hunt, I know it's because like it is a little bit harder for women. You know, our physical capabilities are different than men. And so for a female to go on a sheep hunt and carry the same percentage pack to her body weight and hike the same amount of miles, like that is a hard feat. And so I think that there are so many people in the outdoor community that are just impressed with the fact that anybody did X, Y, or Z. And then I do think that there's still so many people that are just impressed because you're a girl.
My wife's first alpine deer, she was determined to pack the whole thing off herself. And so it was kind of an interesting spot for me to be in, because I would have totally like helped her, but then she didn't need it or didn't want it. So I was, well, fine, that's good for you. And then as we're hiking off, I'm like, well, yeah, of course. Like, I didn't expect that she wouldn't be able to do it, and good for her for doing it. So I did not feel bad whatsoever that I had no meat. I was like, good for her, she can do this. So I'm not like I'm wussing out or anything like that. It's like she shot it, she wants to take it off. Nope, no problem. It's not a threat. It just makes everything that much better. And my pack just happened to be lighter.
And you know, if the tables were turned and you guys were on a hunt and you carried out your whole deer, like most people wouldn't even think about that. It's like that's kind of the norm. And I do try to encourage, you know, the women that I do talk to, like you just got to get out there and try it, and you got to push yourself and challenge yourself to do the things that are hard. But at the same time, like I have found myself, you know, not the exact same story as your wife, but trying to sign myself up for more than maybe I can handle because it's like, am I trying to prove something to myself, or like, is this really going to make me feel better on the other side if I can do this? But I probably wouldn't choose to just pack out a whole animal by myself.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. Yeah. So going on to some of your big time hobbies slash careers here, piloting. How long have you do you own your own plane? How long have you been doing that?
So my husband and I own a Piper PA-14. So, you know, a Cub is a PA-18, so they're very similar, but ours is a four-seater, which is really great. We've owned it for 3 years now. Yeah, I think 3 years. So I've been flying for 2 years. My husband's been flying for 3 years. But my dad has been a pilot for quite some time. So, you know, I kind of grew up sitting passenger with him for so many years, and I loved flying with him so much, and we went all the time together. And then, you know, one day he was like, what do you like, do you think you're ever going to get your PPL? Who am I going to give this plane to when I can't fly anymore? And I don't want to say that was one of the first times I ever thought about like I could be a pilot, but that was probably the biggest realization, like holy cow, I could actually do this, and I could actually maybe one day have my own plane. And then you know, truthfully, so my husband went through his PPL before I did, and which was so great because it's such a kind of a convoluted process, and there's so many different ways to get your pilot's license. And it was kind of nice that he kind of paved that way for me a little bit, so I could envision like this is the kind of program I want to do, this is what I don't want to do. And in short, that's kind of, I guess, the short of we do have our own plane, and we've been flying for a few years now, you know, independently, but I did grow up flying, and we try to get out as much as we can. Our whole life pretty much revolves around supporting the plane.
What's the difference between the 14 and the 18?
So the 18 is a tandem seat, so the pilot sits in front of the passenger. Our 14, the pilot and passenger sit side by side, and then we technically can fit four people, but it would be like two very, very small adults in the back. We max people we fly is like three. But I really like the four seater, the 14, because we have a lot of cargo space, which is really nice. Like, I have a pretty big lab. She's 80 pounds. We have a healer. And so, when it's the two of us, the two dogs, and a weekend full of gear, we really have the cargo space to hold it all. It's they're but performance wise, they're pretty similar airplanes.
How much weight are you taking? Do you like have your scale out in front of you, just kind of like ballpark and have an idea now that
Yeah.
you've done it a bunch?
It depends on what kind of adventure we're going on. Like, if we know we're going to a really easy to get in and out of strip, and there's plenty of space for us, we can kind of ballpark it. But if, like, we know we're going like sheep hunting, we're really doing the math on how much fuel we're taking, how much our packs weigh, where we're dropping fuel, and really trying to get it down to as little weight as possible, because we know the strips that we're getting in and out of are so much more technical and tighter, especially if hopefully we're coming home with the sheep. But it kind of just depends on the mission.
So I know anytime anybody goes to a spot that they have scouted and they're frustrated when someone else is there, that has to
Yeah.
be amplified so much more if you have your own plane. Because if you have your own plane and you show up to this strip, has that ever happened? And if it did, I'd be crushed. If I go to a pullout with my truck, that's one thing. Well, okay, there was a chance someone was going to be there
Yeah.
because people can drive there. But man, it seems like with your own plane, you should just almost expect to have it by yourself.
I know. That's kind of that it, this is such a funny question, because we had the weirdest situation happen to us last sheep season. We absolutely go hunting to get away from everyone. Like, you're totally right. I don't want to see anybody when I'm hunting. And so, especially when you're putting the work in with the plane, and you're thinking, like, okay, out of all the hunters out there, how many of them are really going with planes? Like, what are the chances they're really gonna make it out here or whatever? And yeah, your hope is you're not gonna see a single soul. So our last sheep hunt last year, we went up into the Brooks Range, and my husband had gotten his sheep there the year prior, and we land at this strip, and there's a cub part and then a guide tent, and we knew the guide was probably going to be there that year at at that location. And the guide comes out, and my husband and I are both kind of looking at each other like, oh man, this, like, you just have, like, we've all heard horror stories of Alaska hunters running into guides in the middle of nowhere. It's like, oh man, what's this guy gonna say? And we just our expectations were just blown out of the water. And Dave Marsh, he's so great. He introduced himself and kind of showed us where him and his clients were going to be hunting, and we just had this great conversation about where we were going, and it was totally amicable. He was so welcoming, and even like asked us for our inReach numbers, so in case we needed help, if something, if in case of an emergency, we had his contact information, which was so such a great opportunity for us to like kind of change our mindset on that. Like, we were expecting for him to come out and be super pissed we were out there, and but he was like, you guys are Alaskans, and this is my guiding area, but there's plenty of room for all of us. And it was just a really great lesson. And then so he was there, and then I hope she's going to listen to this, but the cub is another couple from Fairbanks that we did not know was also going out there. And her and the guide had even said, he said, this is so weird, there's two couples out here, like, that's never ever happened before. And I'm thinking, That is so strange, but I kind of love it, you know? And so they came up and we're like, man, we're trying to get in the middle of nowhere. Part of us is pretty bummed that there's people out here. We were expecting the guy, but we weren't expecting this other couple. And but we all made it work. Like, it was no big deal. And I think, you know, prior to this, our mindset would have been a little bit different. And, you know, having had such a positive experience kind of sharing the land, I guess, moving forward, like, we had another incident, not similar to that, but just kind of ran into some people moose hunting, and our mindset just shifted. It's like, we all worked really hard to be here, and this is a little bit crappy. Like, no one wants to be hunting near someone else, but we can be, like, safe and respectful and all have a great time.
Yeah, you don't have to be against each other.
Totally.
When I was up
Yeah, and you can,
there,
like, yeah, and just like the safety aspect of it for me with Dave being like, hey, we're like a, you know, X amount of miles away from you guys. If you need help, like, let us know. Like, that was really nice. Like, he would have dropped everything to come help us if we needed it.
that's awesome.
Yeah.
A buddy of mine were and I were hunting a local mountain, and there were some bears up there. It was September, so we're looking for an alpine bear that's been eating some berries. And because it's a high traffic area, we assumed there'd probably be some other people around. And sure enough, there were some two guys that showed up. So I went over there and said, "Hey, what's going on?" You know, introduced myself and say, "Hey, we're hunting this. Where were you guys going to go?" And they said they were going to go across. And hunt this other mountain. It's like, cool, you know, stay out of each other's way. Good luck over there. You know, we saw a bear over there. And then like 5 minutes later, they'd separated. But then we saw a bear down beneath us where we told him we were going to hunt, or we told the guys we were going to hunt. So we're figuring out a way that my buddy could stalk it because he was bow hunting. And so as we're figuring that out, those other guys swoop down in and shoot the bear, thinking,
Oh
what in the
no.
world? So I mean, it wasn't our bear, you know, it's
Yeah.
public land, you can do what you want, but both of the guys were from out of state. They were up here for Coast Guard, and so nothing to, you know, not begrudging Coast Guard whatsoever, but just if you come from an area that's kind of a first one to see it gets it,
Totally.
and that's, oh man, it's just it's not against the law, but there's some ethics involved. And then the flip side of that, when I was up in Fairbanks a couple of years ago in March for that winter hunt, Buddy and I were out and we hadn't seen any caribou, and it's negative 30, and we're started to head back into Fairbanks, but we stop and because we saw some people that were loading up a couple of caribou on a sled, and so said, "Hey, what's going on? Did you find some caribou?" Trying to ask where the caribou were without asking where the caribou were. And the guy said, "Do you have a pot to boil some water for coffee?" And like, we don't have a percolator, but we do have a pot. So he said, "All right, that'll do." And then he said the caribou were 3 miles that way. And so we went there. It was getting relatively close to dark. It was kind of in that early evening. So we went back there, saw a couple before we got to that 4 mile mark. And so, you know, shot them. And then as we were coming back, they had stayed and waited. Because it was negative 30 and you're not staying out that late. But even though they had theirs, they waited just to make sure that we were coming back okay. And that's like
Oh,
the type of thing that you don't see everywhere. You know, for every,
yeah.
you know, instance in which someone comes right in front there and takes the bear that you're going to go, there's definitely experiences in which people are just thoughtful. And it's not a matter of, I need to get mine like it's the last one. And I think
Yeah.
that is kind of a mutual respect and understanding that not all Alaskans, but a lot of Alaskans do have, and it's pretty cool to experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so often we hear those horror stories of, like kind of like you said, an animal being taken out from underneath you, and it's so hard because, you know, we all worked so hard to get there, and I would say kind of like you mentioned, is the Alaskan mindset is like to be respectful, give each other space, and kind of don't do shady stuff like that. Like, especially if you've had a conversation about it, kind of respect that mutual agreement. But I love hearing those stories of just, you know, hunters helping other hunters, like a boat broken down or snow machine broken down or whatever it is. And it, you know, after this experience with us sheep hunting, we kind of now have this little saying, we're like, we should be more like Dave Marsh, like, you know, the guide, like we can emulate that, you know, welcomeness or like positivity, because you're way more likely to get a positive outcome from an interaction in the middle of nowhere if you're more welcoming than if you come off and you're yelling and screaming at someone for being in the same area as you. Like, nothing good is going to come out of
Right.
that. And especially when there's, I don't know, this always kind of runs in the back of my head, but like there's guns involved. I
Right.
just really would way rather have, you know, mutual respect and all be on the same page and just be able to respectfully walk our different directions.
Right.
But man, I feel like these days it is a little bit, I mean, we've always kind of prided on ourselves on getting out into the middle of nowhere and not being able to see anyone for as long as we wanted. But I don't know if it seems like there's more hunters than ever, but it's a little bit hard to find a quiet area these days, I think.
Yeah, I got a buddy in Hoonah who is unbelievably good and meticulous and maybe a little obsessive about finding people's spots. So he'll listen to a podcast and he'll watch videos and then he'll just figure it out. He'll just spend hours and hours of winter time in Hoonah just finding these spots. And he said there was one they pulled a fast one on me because there was like an old clip from taking off from a different town. But then based on the sun and based on like he just had a general direction, was able to deduce it. And I thought, man, this is
That's crazy.
wild. But if people are if they're going through that much trouble to find stuff, I kind of subscribe to
Yeah.
the if you haven't seen the mountain, you don't really know what it looks like. And if you know what the mountain looks like, then you have probably been there and you already know. So you're not really necessarily telling
Exactly.
anybody anything that they don't already know. Sheep
Yeah.
could be pretty different because yeah, it's sheep. Whereas,
That's pretty sacred, yeah.
yeah, sit the
Yeah.
blacktail down here. It's like, yeah, there's not
Yeah.
really much of a secret. You just go up to where the alpine is, and you know that's kind of
Yeah.
what's going on.
Yeah,
Going
for
back to the
sure.
planes here, I'm on tradeaplane.com here and just looking at used planes, and it's being that I don't really know what to look for. Like, there's a 1979 Piper PA-18 Super Cub for 98,000, but then there's also another one for like 275,000. Like when you're buying
Yeah.
used planes, like how does this work, you know?
Yeah, so for reference, this is so crazy. Our plane is a 1949, which is wild. It's so old, but so all of these planes are just really, really old. But over the years, so much of it isn't original. So when you're, yeah, I mean the price range on these planes, especially if you just walked, you know, anywhere in Alaska at your local airport, you can see planes that are $30,000 to $300,000 that people are all doing, you know, backcountry expeditions with. It's pretty amazing the range of prices. But really the difference in how much you're spending on a plane would be like, for example, like our plane or like a Cub. How well the fabric's taken care of. So like, is the fabric newer? Is it old? Like our fabric is going to be need to be replaced in the next couple of years. That's $50,000. So if you're looking at a plane that just got fabric within the last 10 years, you're good for a long, long time. Like, but you might have a higher price tag because they did put the money into new fabric. Another big one is the different type of engines that get put in. A lot of people will, you know, upgrade their engines every X amount of hours, X amount of years. Those are really expensive, like $15,000 to $20,000, depending on what kind of engine you're putting on. Props, a lot of people put on different types of props on their plane. Those can run up to, I don't know, I'm sure people are going to fact check me on this, but you know, I'm just thinking about like the things we've done to ours or my dad or, you know, friends. It's like you could spend $10,000 to $20,000 on a new crop. Floats, those really, that there's a huge price range in that. So those are like all the accessory items are really what's driving the price up. You can have really nice panels. We have an older panel, older instruments. And then it's kind of similar to like a car. You're also paying for like the hours, like the mileage. Like a higher hour engine is gonna, you're gonna have to replace that. So those are kind of the variables that go into it.
When we flew up for a caribou hunt, we were in a commercial plane. They had the turbo, so like we cruised out there pretty quickly and were able to get elevation pretty quick. And we happened to be at the same strip as a couple, locals who had a private plane, and it was just amazing. You saw the difference. And I don't know, one of my buddies made a comment about the difference in price. The two planes parked right next to each other. One was like, $200,000 more because it's for commercial use. You're doing flight seeing, or
Yeah.
you're doing, this and that, versus, two buddies who happen to have it and they're just going to be taking a whole bunch of different loads back and forth with their moose. But it's interesting to see just that discrepancy when you don't really know a whole lot, when you're just used to used vehicles and whatnot. It's pretty shocking.
It is, and I think it's so funny to walk around an airport. We love walking around our small plane airports here in Fairbanks. It's just so fun to look at what people have and what they're doing to their planes and stuff. But kind of like I mentioned, most of these planes are very, very old, and most of them are beat up. They have super retro paint jobs. Some of them are missing paint on parts and pieces, like. You could have a really expensive plane and it just looks so crappy from the outside. Like I love that. It's kind of like a hidden gem, and they're just planes with so much character and you can just tell that like they have so many stories. But that plane, I mean, you could be looking at a $150,000 plus plane, but it looks like a tin can from the outside. But when you open up the cowling and you know what accessories are on it, that's where the worth is. But I just love like a good old timer with a beat up plane that's just worth so much money and they're driving a beat up car and and then there's the flip side. There's people who have the super nice shiny planes with decals and great paint jobs and it just anything like Alaska, there's always this huge diversity, I guess.
Yeah, righty. So moving on to photography, I guess that's a pretty good segue there. I was talking with a couple filmmakers on the podcast over the years, and I asked them about gear and equipment and this and that, and I tell them that I had like a, the kit camera from Costco, and they're like, "Oh, well, that's fine too." So as a photographer, what do you use gear wise? Obviously, there's it's like cell phones take great photos. But if you really want professional grade photos, there's a lot of stuff that's going to separate a cell phone photo, obviously with the zoom too, from your kit lenses and then like your really, really good lenses. So how did
For
that
sure.
progression happen? Did you start off pretty small, cheap, and then as your skills grew, you upgraded, or did you just go all in?
Yeah, so I used to love taking pictures with my phone whenever we were on adventures. And every hunting season, I would say, man, I really wish I had a camera. And then, hunting season would be over and it would totally exit my mind. So my husband surprised me with a camera for Christmas one year and he got me the Canon Rebel T6, which is one of the most basic Canon models you can get with the kit lens. And throughout the years, I would upgrade a lens like every couple of years. And I used that camera for 5 years, I think. And most of the work that you see up until the last couple months has all been on the Rebel T6, which that the whole package was less than $1,000.
I think that's the
And
exact one
I
I
kind of
had.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. And I was, when I first got it, I was like, oh man, this is one of the most basic cameras. Maybe I should upgrade it. Like I kept thinking, I think I need something better. And then all the kind of research I did, it just encouraged, amateur photographers to really learn how to shoot manual before you upgrade your system. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to really learn this camera inside and out, and I'm going to feel really confident in my shooting abilities before I invest money into it. I want to make sure that this is something I like doing and I'm okay at before I put any additional money into it. So I started getting like some paid gigs in the last year or so, which I wasn't really seeking, and but I really enjoyed doing them. Like I did an elopement, which was awesome. Like we got flown out into the Alaska Range and just a few unique projects here and there. And so I kind of was like, man, it's probably time I really invest in a better camera. And like I felt like I finally hit my confidence mark at about 4 years into photography, where I felt like I could invest the money and feel really good on the other side of it. So I just bought the R6 Mark II, the mirrorless Canon, and I love it so much. It is such a great camera. The clarity is just really amazing, but I am glad I waited because it is an expensive piece of equipment, and but I do have like the, I guess, the ease of mind knowing that I love photography, no matter if I'm getting paid or doing it just for fun. And now I actually know how to use a camera that's worth something, I guess. Yeah,
Yeah.
but I just wouldn't,
Go
oh,
ahead.
if anyone's, you know, I would just would encourage people just buy whatever you're comfortable affording, and you can always upgrade it. But you know, I just am always nervous to encourage people to really dive into something, you know, putting a lot of money into it unless you really know you like doing it.
Yeah. I upgraded to Sony A6, and it's after like there had been different iterations, so it wasn't like the top of the line, and so the price was down a little bit, and it was super fun to like after shooting manual, you kind of know the difference in what you want, and then a better lens is going to get you sharper photos, and so if you know what you're looking for, then you can kind of make things a little bit better. And I'm still learning, but like knowing enough that you can make the most out of the camera. When you are out there, like what's kind of impacted your style, or what are you looking for? Because anybody can really be a decent photographer just because you're in Alaska. Like there's just amazing things just all around. So how do you develop your style, and how do you stand out?
Well, I got some advice, I would say, in the like the first year of taking pictures, and someone said, don't take the same picture more than twice without changing your settings or wherever you're standing. And so I, you know, or else I guess when I first started, I would take 10 of the same picture, and then it's like, okay, I didn't change anything. These all look the same. This is bogging me down in processing. So, you know, jump forward to now, I really try to keep that in mind. Like, if I'm going to take a picture, I am confident that the first time I take this picture, it's, you know, my settings are going to be pretty great for what I want. And then if I kind of just think of like, what are some other angles or variations I can do to make this picture a little bit more unique versus the first, my first instinct. So like, could I kneel down? Could I get, you know, what kind of different compositions can I get for this one shot that I'm looking at? But I would say more like style-wise, I've really gravitated towards like lifestyle and outdoor photography in the last few years. Like I love taking pictures of, you know, my husband's probably my best model, but like I love taking pictures of him hunting. Or when we're flying, like I love taking pictures of people doing outdoorsy things that they really love to do. And it kind of gives a unique perspective to those who don't really have those opportunities, I guess. So yeah, when we're out, I just try to look for like, what, is this shot going to even like somewhat reflect the beauty that I'm seeing in real life or not? And sometimes it's just not even worth it to take the picture because it's just never going to be as beautiful. And then there's other times where I'm like, oh, I really want to get myself set up really well and take a couple shots because this is such a gorgeous scene. I just really would love to see if I can capture it. And it's going to be, kind of stay true to what my memory of it was, I guess.
The Northern Lights is always a thing that's worth seeing and worth photographing. We never really get them down here because it's always cloudy on the high activity days or nights. But when you're shooting the Northern Lights, like, what are some tips for that? When I was first trying to take photos, I would look at what I shot and then what someone else did, and I thought that no, that's not what happened last night. That's not at all. So, what would be some, if someone was looking to take some pictures of the Northern Lights, what do they have to keep in mind, or what are some setting tips or shutter speed or like any of that sort of stuff.
I really love taking Northern Light photos. It's super fun and it's such a great way to experience them. Why else are you going to get out of bed at 1 in the morning when it's 20 below?
Right.
So I would say that you don't have to invest in a Northern Light lens, but it's important to shoot on a lens that is really catered for those wide angle, really low f-stop shots. Looking at like a 1.2 lens, any like 17 millimeter, even you could have a little bit of a range, but I, for a long time, would rent a lens, a Northern Light lens from my local camera shop. Because I wasn't shooting the Northern Lights all the time, so it wasn't really worth it for me to invest in a lens specific for that. And that made a world of difference. So I would highly recommend renting a few lenses. And there's even some online camera gear stores that will let you rent as well. I hate to imagine what the price is for Alaska, but most camera shops do rentals, and it's highly worth taking the time to do. And then say you love the lens, just go out and buy it if you think you're going to use it. The right lens is probably the most important. And then something that I really started to notice in my Northern Light photos versus others was the composition in the photo. So, if you just take a shot of the Northern Lights in the sky, it's pretty, but it's not usually super amazing. Like the photos I'm really drawn to our Northern Light reflection in the water. Like those are really incredible. Or Northern Lights over mountains, Northern Lights over a cabin that's has some lights on in the windows. So it's my inclination when I first started shooting them was to just take pictures of the sky or take pictures of the tops of trees with the Northern Lights, and they just weren't that great. So I started to scout out areas ahead of time before the lights came out. So when I did know that the lights were going to be great one night, I already had a spot in mind and I already had a couple shots, like a couple different perspectives in mind. So like a few of my favorites have been a water reflection shot on the our Tanana River. The Northern Lights were over it, so that was always a shot I really wanted to get. So I knew I could do that in the fall. Or one of my favorites is like I have a bridge in it, with some snow on the bridge, and so it's kind of putting in a little bit of work ahead of time to have an idea of where you want to shoot when it's dark, because it's always a little bit more rushed in the dark, and you feel like you have to get all your gear out really fast. And think about what you want in the shot, like hills, trees, a fence line, a puddle, river, whatever it is. But I think those aspects are what make Northern Light pictures really incredible. It's not just the night sky. And then more on gear, I guess, a great tripod. I have a pretty lightweight one. I just throw it in my camera bag and carry it with me all the time. But if you were really going to get into Northern Light photos, you can really invest in some pretty nice bags. I'm sorry, tripods. And some of them will you can hook your bag onto. So like say it's windy, it's kind of weighted down. So a good tripod. And then I like to either have like my camera app on my phone or do a delayed shutter, so like a 2 second timer on my camera. So when I hit my shutter, the camera's still before it takes the actual picture, or else you're gonna have that blur.
That tripod was an important thing. I remember the first when I first moved back in 2013, I was trying to take those photos and I was just trying to hold still. It's impossible. Like it'll pick up your heart beating. It's just there's zero chance of that working out.
Totally, especially when you have like a 15 to 30 second shutter. It's really hard. Even I find it's hard to like rest it on your car or like rest it on something that is solid. Like the tripod really is the way to go.
What about the editing? Because you can go on now and you can have AI and Photoshop and everything. There's always been ways to kind of manipulate the photos. How much editing do you do on yours, and at what point does it kind of cease to be an image and more of a like illustration?
Yeah, I love that. There's been such a shift in the last couple of years with editing photos, and there's just some photos that you look at and you just know that's not how it looked, because it's so overly edited. And that's some people's styles, and that's all good. It's not mine. I got into photography because I really wanted to have I just wanted to show people these amazing places that I saw that most people never get the experience to see. And so I really try in my editing style to make it look as real as it did, or like how it made me feel. So sometimes if I catch myself over editing something, I'll just step away from the computer and then kind of come back to it later, and with that in mind, and kind of go back to being a little bit more natural, or kind of know what settings I was overusing or not. But I always try to keep it pretty natural. Northern light photos are a little bit challenging to edit. A lot of photographers will do like a really high vibrance or saturation, and to really bring those colors out. I always like a high contrast. It kind of makes the lights look a little bit more crisp, and if the stars are out, those will pop out a little bit more. But I don't know. I just like a more naturally edited photo than anything too crazy. And I know with like AI, people can say like pop a cabin in here, put the Northern Lights in here, whatever. Like I saw one the other day that was like the inside of a DC-6 with mountains and the Northern Lights, and it was like the view from the cockpit, and there was like snow on the windshield of this plane. I was like, I can't imagine anyone would think this is real. Like there's no way. Like this whole thing, someone curated it using AI, which that's a creative niche for some people, but I always just kind of like to keep it a little bit more natural.
Yeah, that's going to be a tough or an interesting thing to navigate in the coming years. Journalism, photography, the generative AI, you can stylistically make things interesting and fun, and art can definitely be, or AI can definitely benefit art, but also there's that level of purity and individual creativity. And at what point does it cease to really be yours when AI is too involved? And yeah, I'm hoping that, and I'm assuming that people will continue to really value authentic human art and individual creativity. But some of the AI stuff looks cool. I just hope that it never surpasses humans.
I think so too. And I think for so many people that are outdoorsy, like you have some semblance of what it took for someone to get out to where they were. Like I love a great aviation shot, like a wing-to-wing picture, or like there's just some really talented photographers in like the Mat-Su area that just do some really incredible work. And it's like, man, you know how hard of a shot it is to get or how hard it is to get a great shot of a plane moving from another plane. Like that's a lot of work, that's a lot of talent. Or like some of these Northern Light photos that you see, it's someone sat out in the cold and hiked out in the middle of nowhere to take this photo. Like there's just so much more that goes behind the scenes. And I think that's kind of part of the art, but it's like you truly know a photographer is loving what they're doing if they're going out to these areas, and the picture is just a little piece of it.
Do you think about the days when people were shooting film and just what an adventure that
Oh,
would have been?
yeah. Yeah. So my dad used to shoot film, and he always told me this story that he was moose hunting, and they were on the Yukon, big moose hunt, and he was out by himself and came back and was joking around with my grandpa, and he was like, "Yeah, I shot this bull 7 times." And they were like, "What? Oh my gosh, why'd you shoot a moose 7 times?" They're like, "Well, where is he? What'd you do?" And he was like, "No, I shot him 7 times with my camera. Like, I just wanted to, like, I never get close-ups of, I guess this bull just walked right under his tree stand." And he, it's just, it's funny to think about, especially in today's age when we have our phones in one hand, we have our cameras in the other. You could walk away from a 30-minute photo session with a few hundred photos. And so to think back to film days when you really have to put a lot of thought into your the few shots that you have, I think we'd all probably be more talented photographers if we were limited on what how many shots we could take.
That delayed gratification, and you'd know a
Totally,
lot
yeah.
more about numbers. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what do the adventures look like this spring and this summer?
So, oh my gosh, we've had a great spring in Fairbanks. We have had quite the fool spring a couple times. So we'll have a week of like 40 degrees and then a week of snowing. But my husband and I just went to the College Glacier this past weekend with our snow machines and winter camped in our Arctic oven and went backcountry skiing with our dogs. It was phenomenal. We're both so sunburnt right now. It's just those things as Alaskans, you don't think to bring sunscreen anywhere, let alone in April. So we would like to do a couple more winter camp or spring camping adventures with the skis. Hopefully, we've got a cabin in the Brooks Range and would really like to get out there. And it's this really kind of fine line because if we have we need to get out there before our airport loses enough snow because we have to be able to land at the cabin with skis on the plane. So it's kind of this tricky predicament, kind of navigating how much snow do we have there? How much snow do we have here? Can we leave Fairbanks with snow and come home in 3 days with snow? Or do we have to, can the spring trip? So yeah, pretty much I would say those are the big ones is some maybe hopefully some Brooks Range expeditions in the plane and a few backcountry skiing trips.
Is there much skiing up
Yeah.
in Fairbanks? I'm sure you have Nordic skiing, but is there a lift and is there some downhill stuff?
Yeah. We have a couple downhill ski hills that they're okay. I mean, compared to Alyeska, they're
Yeah,
nothing
nothing.
to write home
Yeah.
about. Yeah. It's I mean, so many of it. Fairbanksons go to Girdwood to really get like a great ski weekend in. But if you're a lot of people use them and they're good hills, but they're hills. They're definitely not mountains. There's a lot of people in the interior that kind of do what we did this past weekend and you take your snow machines out and then use your snow machines to backcountry ski, which is pretty fun. But yeah, the Nordic skiing community is huge in Fairbanks.
My wife and I went to
Yeah.
Juneau because that's our closest ski resort, and it was just a lot
Oh,
of fun
yeah.
to be on a
I
mountain, like you
love
said.
Juneau.
And that's kind of the I don't know if Petersburg or somewhere like halfway in between is kind of the separator where the snow really starts because we just get so much rain. I think we had 179 inches of rain last year and just a couple
Oh my
feet. So
gosh. I
it's
can
almost not
imagine.
even. If you try to skin up a road to get to the Alpine and make a couple runs, it's just a lot of work for not much. And the snow's,
Yeah.
maybe decent a few times a year. So that
Yeah,
is
and
one
how
thing we don't
incredible is
like.
it? Yeah, and it's just like with Eagle Crest or Alyeska, it's like how amazing and how lucky are we to be able to be sitting atop of a ski hill looking at the ocean.
Yeah,
Like,
exactly.
where in the world can you do that? And yeah, I think that the obviously the Girdwood area is just great, or Valdez is great for skiing, but Southeast kind of where you guys are at and where we're at, it's just not the most ideal conditions, but you got to make do.
Yeah, it's not the reason anybody lives here or there. There are a lot of other
Yeah.
reasons, but
Yeah, for sure.
so where can people find you? How can people listen to the podcasts or check out your photography portfolio? Where can people find all that?
Yeah. So I have a couple more episodes on the Soul Summit podcast coming out every Wednesday for the next few weeks, and really excited about a couple guests coming up. And so that can be found on any listening platform, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. It's just under Soul Summit Podcast. My personal Instagram is Kelly Hoffman Reynolds, and my photography website is kellyreynoldsphoto.com. So if anyone ever wants to chat or grab a beer and talk all things outdoors or whatever, feel free to reach out and hit me up.
Awesome. Thanks very much. Been great to chat with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been really nice.